Hey, and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. This is Willem Vanderhorst, your host for the show. I'm glad to be back already. Much more frequent. I only published last week, and I've got a few other conversations. I'm getting back on track with the podcast. Not exactly sure it'll always be this frequent, but it's looking good for the next few weeks for sure. I have a bunch of exciting conversations coming up. And let's start with this one. I had a fantastic conversation with a strategist, Rob Estreitinho. Yes, that's right. Sorry, I wanted to pause and make sure I was trying to get the name right. I may have made a mistake, but I think that's how it's pronounced more or less the second time I pronounced it. And I'm not going to do that again because I'm going to fail. Although, well, I don't know if I will or not. But anyway, Rob is an awesome strategist, really switched on. He's been contributing a lot to the strategy community at large, I would say. He's from Portugal. He lives in London. I met Rob a couple of times, and we talked about that in the episode a few years ago when I was living in London in 2016 for a open strategy event. And at another time, we just like caught a coffee or something. And he now works as a senior strategist for an agency called VCPKin. A lot of his background is in social media. He writes an awesome newsletter called Solomon Theory, in which he has either there's written interviews of other people who work in communications, creative communications, marketing, advertising, strategy. He also publishes quite a few things, articles on LinkedIn and on his Twitter feed. So, I mean, he publishes on Twitter. Yes, he does technically publish on Twitter. Anyway, he writes stuff on Twitter. You can follow him on Twitter at Rob is Typing. And Rob is Typing is his Instagram account. And we talk about his views on what Twitter is good for him, you know, views of like what's happened in his past about embracing completely and then rejecting and then playing around with social media, what kind of stuff he played with as a kid and what he sees strategy as. I think it's a light trigger, but you never know. We talk about school bullying, so that's a thing to be aware of. It's not a heavy topic, or I mean, it can be, but not in this conversation, but just for you to be aware of before the conversation starts. And just in case you have kids around, there's a couple of F words in the conversation as well. Not just literally two, I think, maybe three. But just so you know, what else? A bit of housekeeping stuff. If you enjoy the show, if you enjoy the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast, it would be awesome and fantastic. And I would hugely appreciate if you could give the show a rating and a review. So that's in iTunes or your Apple Podcasts app. If you go and give it a 5-star, please, review. It helps other people find the show. It helps me and it encourages me to keep doing more episodes and recording. The same thing, if you just share it with a friend, if you enjoy the episode, share it with a friend, share it with somebody else, post it on your own social media. You can give me a shout out and tell me what you think, if you particularly appreciate, or send me a question. If you don't like it, tell me too. Don't put that in a review though. So my Twitter account is icvillem. There's like sirens going on in the background. I'll see if I can hear that or not. I don't know if you can hear that or not. I'll see when I'm editing. I hope I don't have to record this once again. Although, I mean, I will record it again if I need to. But yeah, I live in a city. There's sirens. That happens. So it's Chicago, that is, in case you don't know. So my Twitter handle. My Twitter handle is at ICVillem. Letters I and C and W-I-L-L-E-M. Same one for Instagram. My Instagram's the same. I got some inspiration from Rob about what I could be doing with my Instagram. He does a lot of really cool experimentation with his Instagram that I like a lot. The full-on website, if you want to find all the other episodes, if you want to find, I recently published a post, which is also available on Medium and LinkedIn and on my website about all about playing with strategy, inspired by a post I read, which is similar to a couple of other principles of gaming I read by a professor of psychology at Boston College, Professor Peter Gray, about the value of play and the characteristics of play, which inspired me to write some ideas and thoughts about how could you bring play to the creative briefing process if you're a strategist, which may well apply to other business meetings as well. But have a look at that. So I'm inspired these days. I'm going to be writing more posts about what I know from games and play and where those can be brought to different stages of the work of strategy in creative communications and all sorts of other creative process within creative advertising and marketing and branding. That was a tangent. I was talking about the website URL, which is icecreamforeveryone, everything spelled out, .net. www.icecreamforeveryone.net. And so my email, if you want to send me an email about anything, is willem@icecreamforeveryone.net. For example, you can get in touch by email if you have a project to work on. If you're, you know, an emergency, you need a strategist to work on some project, you need to find out about a brand, you are interested in hearing more about my ideas of doing brand and brainstorm and research and creative briefing, including elements of tabletop play and games, then send me an email. I'm available right now for new projects, or at least I have space for new projects. So if you need a strategist for hire, give me a shout. That could be working directly with businesses and brands or working for agencies, no problem. Like, you know, whether it's for a pitch. And I'm based in Chicago, but I can easily travel. So if you're anywhere in the States or Europe or anywhere you need me, I'm more than happy to hear about it. One more thing, subscribe to the newsletter. I'm doing all of my promo at the same time, guys. So subscribe to the newsletter. The newsletter is Ice Cream Sunday, sent on a Sunday. I had a long break for a year. Again, I mentioned that during the episode and the conversation I had with Rob. I'm trying out, it's pretty much the same format as before. Well, first, check it out. You can subscribe on the website. Go and, you know, you can look up the newsletter. These days, it's the same as I was doing a year ago, which is just a couple of short paragraphs, depending, some thoughts, what I'm up to, what's going on with me. Have I published anything? Is there anything published either in the podcast or on my website? And then what I'm calling the weekly combo, two or three flavors, which are generally two or three links with a little bit of a blurb as to like why I think those two or three links are particularly interesting together. They might seem unrelated, but for whatever reason, I thought that they had something interesting going on together. So that's what the newsletter is. Nothing too crazy. Back recording on the podcast Le Voix d'Altaride with friends in France. If you don't speak French, you're probably not interested in this. But in case you do, or you want to practice your French and listen to people talk about tabletop role-playing games, Les Voix d'Altaride, I'll put the link in the show notes. And what else? I think that's about it for now. Yeah, that's about it for now. All right, well, without further ado, enjoy the conversation I had with Rob. Hey, Rob, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely, thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it. It's cool. We were just saying, and I thought we might as well press record because we're just going to go and talk about a bunch of stuff, but the last time we saw each other was in London when I was there. So I think it was 2016. Was it after a Google event or the one that Mark Pollard came to talk at the Open Strategy event, which was somewhere, I can't remember where it was, an agency?
Oh, my, Your memory is better than mine. All I remember is all I remember is we did meet at an event, and it was at the time in my life where I had just recently gone freelance. So I was asking around, or I was planning on going freelance maybe, and I was just asking around for advice, to be honest. And given you had been doing it for a while, I just thought, hey, why not talk to Willem and see what, you know, just hear him out. So yeah. I do have to say, I don't think at the time I mentioned, but I've always been very awkward about meeting people like that and just having some food and chatting. And I feel like freelancing, it kind of started there, but I feel like freelancing helped unlock a little bit of that in me. So I now feel far more comfortable just going, hey, can I buy you a beer and just talk about whatever. So yeah, that was a start.
Is that cool? So what was the thing that that you found a little bit difficult in the first place? Or I don't know if difficult is the right word, but, you know, that you had to get used to or into?
I've just always been quite socially anxious in some ways. And I've always been quite shy as well. No one believes me when I say this, but I'm an incredibly shy person. And especially around groups, I'm better at one-on-ones. I don't know. It was just part of it maybe was the feeling of why the hell would this person give their time to me? And part of it was how the hell am I going to maintain an interesting conversation with them? And then it just turns out that if you, if you go with a few key questions you want to learn, but then just let the conversation unfold, it's usually all right. Like if people are making it hard for you, then it kind of often says more about them than it does about you. So I just learned to relax a bit more over time, that when I enter those conversations, after a few, like, you know, 5-10 minutes of sort of contextual chat, if you know what I mean, like, you know, how's it going, how's work, etc., you just get into a really nice flow. But it kind of comes with age as well, you know. It's, you know, I'm 30 now. Being 30 is different than being 25, which is when I moved to London. So it just comes with like life experience a little bit, I think.
Yeah. And I think, well, what comes automatically along with that is practice. Life experience and the years is more practice makes it, you know, a little bit more comfortable.
Yeah, 100%. It's basically the same. It's the same thing that a lot of people will tell you about interviews. You know, an interview is never easy, but it gets a little bit easier as you do more of them. Even if sometimes you just do them for practice, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because it helps you understand how you think as well. Because if someone asks you, like, tell me about you, like, that is not an easy question, because it's very easy for you to ramble on and not really know what's your story or what do you believe in and stuff like that. So I've just learned to embrace those conversations as one, a really good way to just connect with people that I know from like Twitter and LinkedIn, and just, you know, just knowing that person a little bit better. And then two, I always take something from it, whether that's, I don't know, just a way of thinking or a specific anecdote or a piece of knowledge or a book I should read, and et cetera. And there's value in that you don't get from the likes of Twitter. And I love Twitter, by the way, but it's just different.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. That's exactly, I mean, ultimately why and how I started having these podcast conversations.
Mm-hmm.
After trying to make complicated efforts as to think about what would be the best podcast concept or show to help me in my freelance career, or find a theme that would be interesting to people who would be potentially liable to hire me. And then I was like, it's too complicated. I need to find something that I would enjoy doing regardless of the results. Mm-hmm. And something I do enjoy doing is talking with people.
Yeah, exactly.
Just about, you know, like-minded, interesting people, and little by little, just trying to put a little bit more of a theme to what I'm doing. And even just, it's funny how I've struggled with that. Or I found myself being resistant to choosing and picking the right words, or working on what would be the right words about what this thing is about that I'm doing. Even though I tend to, you know, give out and dish out that kind of advice to clients and brands and marketing to say they should totally be about one thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you mentioned that. A couple of months ago, I was having a conversation with Rob Campbell from RGA, because he's just moved to London. And I was, again, I was just like, oh, hi, can I like buy you a beer and talk to you about a couple of things that I'd like to learn more about? And I started talking to him about Salmon Theory, my newsletter, and it's the exact same question you were just raising. So like, how do I position this thing, and what is like the single-minded thought behind it and all of that? And after a while, he just said, don't take this the wrong way, but I feel like you're trying to justify this project existing. Just do what you enjoy. And then if there's a pattern, it's going to emerge. But like, don't feel the need to create rules around what you want or do not want to do with it. Just go with what feels right for you. Like, it's your thing. You're not answering to stakeholders. You're not answering to board of directors. Just do what you enjoy and do what you think works. But you do it for fun, you know? It's extra time on your life. It's not your day job. So just be cool with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And did you find, I was wondering about that when you were talking about, you know, reaching out to people and talking to people, asking for advice and looking for jobs as freelancer, extending your network. Did you find those kinds of, skills or actions benefiting in other areas of your life?
What do you mean, like in terms of?
I mean, so whatever you found that you had to practice because you weren't really in the habit of like getting out and reaching out to people and talking, but you were a little bit shy. Through that practice of meeting more people and starting to enjoy it. So obviously you've got, you know, learning and meeting people for work. And I was just wondering if there was anything that it was not a prepared question or anything. If you found value and benefit for other areas of your life. And whatever you had to do to go find freelance work, meet new people, and perhaps go through, you know,
I think it does. I think it did in the sense that it allowed me to put a bit less pressure on what I expect from those conversations, because a lot of the things that I say to juniors now, because every so often it's quite funny how now I get a couple of emails from juniors every like full moon and asking me for advice. I'm like, I'm not really sure what you're expecting from this conversation, but sure. But one of the things that I always tell them is, like, don't go to someone expecting them to offer you a job on the spot, but go to someone expecting to build rapport with them. And that just allows you to like remove some of the pressure of what exactly you're trying to do. Because I've just never heard a lot of stories, and maybe I'm doing it wrong, where people go and have a coffee with someone like Mark Pollard or Rob Campbell, and then after the conversation, they go, "Great, I want to hire you." I don't think it works that way, or at least I haven't seen it.
I don't. It's not happened to me either.
Yeah. So, you know, cut yourself some slack over what you're expecting from that conversation. And just, it's the start of something. It's not the end of that thing.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I would say is that, so I'm not freelancing anymore. I went full time about a year and a half ago at an agency called VCCP. And the reason I did that was, what I was looking with freelancing, which was to diversify the type of strategy work I was doing, I'm getting that here. And plus other more like life things, like, you know, planning on buying a house and et cetera. It's just easier to apply for a mortgage when you're full-time employed instead of independently employed. But in general, I started enjoying what I was getting here. But one of the things that I noticed is that a lot of the habits that I have for my freelancing life, I apply them here. So for example, one of the things that I really like to do is if, let's say I send an old staffer asking for like retail advice or retail measurement models or like how retailers do brand tracking and et cetera, because I don't know these things. And, you know, on a couple of instances, this is actually something that happened. A few of the planners that worked across the partnership that have worked on retail and those types of models, they reply with a few thoughts and et cetera. And my very first instinct is like, can I come to wherever you sit and we just have a 30-minute conversation about this? So I just found that it doesn't have to live on email. And to be honest with you, I benefit far more when I actually go and talk to people. So stuff like that, I think, before... my freelancing days weren't really natural behavior for me. But I just found that it's sort of my way of approaching, if you will, like office politics, because they do exist and they're quite important, although most people don't want to admit that. But it's just helped me find a way to be more comfortable with that face-to-face, building rapport, knowing when and who to talk to, not because you're after something that they have or you want to get a promotion or anything, but just because you're genuinely curious about what they're doing. So I love talking to planners who don't work where I work. So I love talking to planners down in retail, and I love talking to planners in CRM. And I work with the brand planners quite a lot, and I love that too. But even then, beyond that, outside of VCCP, it's something that I still find myself doing consistently. I'll email people that I find interesting and just go, I haven't seen you in 4 months. Let's grab a beer. Then let's talk about what you're working on. Let's talk about, you know, whatever, life, work, anything. So it's become like a mode of approaching how I deal with work, even if I don't really have a vested interest in terms of, I don't need a new job right now, right? I'm pretty happy at VCCP. I'm not looking to move to another agency, but that doesn't mean I shouldn't be interested in talking with people from other agencies, just about how's it going for them. That's definitely influenced a lot of how I spend my work weeks. And a lot of the times I actually need to be a bit mindful that, you know, I do spend evenings at home. So me and my girlfriend have this like rule where I basically try and not have more than one or two things a week where that's sort of depriving me from being around the house at like dinner time. Just because, you know, back in when I was freelancing, it kind of became a bit too much, to be honest. So we just went, okay, there must be a balance there. But it's something I very, very much enjoy doing to this day, and hopefully to the rest of my career. I don't think I'll ever be too senior to enjoy those things, or I hope not, anyway.
I hope not either. Just one thing, just to make sure where I thought I was going to ask you, because we just like went straight into talking about agency stuff, but not everybody listening to this is necessarily working in advertising or is a planner or a strategist. Mm-hmm. What's your quick take or quick summary when you explain to somebody who's not in this industry of what it is you do? What's a planner and the other acronyms that you used when you're describing others like CRM?
Oh, man. Well, the quick and easy answer is...
I mean, I know that, so just like my brothers and sisters for a long time just told me basically that I seem to have the Chandler's job. If you're a member from Friends, nobody knows what Chandler does, so that's...
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
They ended up, like, I think he does what Chandler did.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the short answer is I avoid talking about work, but when people do ask me about it, I think the best I can come up with is I help the campaigns work better. You know, I don't do the ideas. I don't write the scripts. I definitely don't do any of the filming. I definitely don't talk to clients every single day, but I help make sure that the campaign works and does what it's intended to do. And then if people ask, oh, what does that mean? Then I might go, oh, well, you know, if you're thinking about how advertising on TV is different from advertising in print and from advertising on the internet, etc. There's different, those things have ways of working together. So that's kind of my job to figure out is how do those things work together and how do they give results to what a brand wants to be remembered for or a specific KPI they might have, etc. I don't go to that level of detail, but only if they ask. But the baseline answer is, you know, a lot of people have ideas. I help make sure that the ideas work as hard as they can to deliver results.
Perfect. This is great. Another thing I just thought, it was not in my notes, but it was a bit opportunistic, as you just mentioned, being at VCCP for a year and a half now. And I hope it's not a delicate question, but I don't think so. But I remember I was listening to the chat that you had with Mark Pollard. I'll add this in the show notes as well. But at mm-hmm. the time you talked to him, you'd been there for a few months only. And you talked about expecting whether there would be, I don't know, some kind of bump where it might be difficult after a few months or you might get bored. I was wondering if you experienced that at any point in the past year or something like that.
I don't think so, but I think part of it is, I think, a testament to what I think is a really good place to work. But part of it is also my own personality and some of my points of view on work and why I do enjoy doing this stuff. So if you listen to the Mark Pollard interview, a lot of where he's coming from is he's trying to understand with every person he talks to, like what actually drives you to do this job. I think for most of my career, I found myself wanting to do this job because I get bored quite easily and I need to sort of do a thing, move on, do the next thing and then cycle. So in that sense, freelancing was brilliant. And in that sense, the whole idea of, you know, I think at the time what I said was I have like a 6-month test. So after 6 months, I start getting a sense of the good and the bad. And a certain employer or company will start getting a sense of what's good about me and what's bad about me. And then there's sort of an implicit calibration of whether the thing is working or not. It's a bit like relationships, right? You only know if you really like someone after the first fight. Until the first fight, I don't really care because it's all, you know, unicorns and rainbows. And that's the easy part. The hard part is you have the first fight, you have the first bad project, you have the first slightly rude email response, and et cetera, and et cetera. And those things exist, right? That's the reality. So even after that, if you go overall, it's still the balance is still pretty good, then great. That means that we're both happy with the relationship. So I think, like I said, part of it is I found that the balance here has been quite good for me. So I'm not going to pretend that it's perfect. Of course, there's always bumps in projects, but the benefit of it and the people I work with, I think, have most definitely overshadowed the bad stuff. But then personally, I found myself, don't really know why, if you ask me in detail, but I found myself appreciating more the value of committing to a thing for the long term. So say a project where you don't just do a one-off strategy thing, you actually want to see it through. And what it means to see it through is to stay 8 months with it. And then by the time it's done, you go, okay, great, now we need to think about next year. And I just found myself really appreciating that in a way that I'd never really appreciated before. Because before I was very fireworks driven, you know, oh, is this cool and exciting? And oh, okay, done. It's like a, you know, it's like a heroin hit. It hits you and then it's downhill from there. Whereas now I find myself just appreciating more the idea of being on a project for a prolonged period of time, working with a team that I know really well for a slightly more longer period of time, and just having a bit more of a personal commitment to stuff. So in that sense, I'm not sure if I hadn't changed that and how I see work and why I do it. I'm not sure, you know, VCCP could have been the best agency in the world, but if I hadn't changed that in my outlook and how I deal with difficulty, I'm not sure I would have stuck around for a year and a half now. And with the, you know, if you ask me, how long do you want to stay there? I'm like, I don't really know. I just want to ride this wave as much as possible. So I'd say it's kind of those two things have slightly changed it for me.
All right. Thank you. Cool. Let's go back a little bit. I was thinking I know that, but people listening might not. You're from Portugal. Where'd you grow up?
Lisbon. Outside of Lisbon, not the main city. I grew up in a small town, which I think you could technically say it's the countryside.
Like borderline suburbia, but countryside, or further away than suburbs, or?
Definitely suburbs, yeah. So basically, I always joke I grew up on the side of a mountain. But what that really means is I lived in a residential neighborhood, which happened to be in a slightly mountainous area, because basically Lisbon is in the middle of a valley, and I lived in one of the sides of the valley. So as you start going upwards, that's sort of where the town I grew up was.
Got it. One question I started being interested in, and there's a couple of things I found in some articles. I didn't have to take tons of time to prepare, but I did dig up a few things. What was your favorite form of play as a kid? How did you enjoy playing?
Lego and plasticine. Until I found out video games, but I think plasticine was like, well, Lego and plasticine were life changers.
Plasticine, Play-Doh? Is that what it, like yeah, Play-Doh? Yeah. Is that what you mean? Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So I just really, well, for practical reasons, but also for, I don't know, maybe it started as a practical reason, but now in hindsight, I just see it as something bigger than that. But I've always liked Lego and the likes of Play-Doh because you could have the same set of toys, but every single time you feel like you had different toys because you can mold them into whatever you want. And you can, you know, maybe a few Lego OCD Nazis will sort of tell me off on this, but I actually enjoyed mixing and matching the parts. So swapping one guy's head for the other guy's head. And before I know it, I have a whole different world. And the reason I say a lot of people might tell me off on this was I was talking about this very same thing on Saturday with a friend, and he was like, "You did what?" And so, you know, there was a bit of a half a second of tension, and then it was fine. But his philosophy on it is that you don't mix and match Lego universes, Matt. And I was just like, well, you know, you could.
All right. Stick to each universe, yeah, and you follow the instructions in the book. Like that kind of, was that his or her thing?
Well, his thing was basically, look, if you have a police set, you can't have a pirate in there. And I was like, well, what if the pirate is lost? And what if they're both in another universe and none of them know what the fuck's going on? That in itself is such an interesting storyline. I think his thing was his brother kind of once put some police officers in a giant pirate ship. And he was just like, this just feels wrong. But yeah, for me, it was always the fun bit. It was the mixing and matching.
What was important? So I remember for me, because I played a lot of Lego as well, not so much plasticine, but building the models was important to me. And I mean, like, not necessarily the instructions, but like building my own and mixing stuff as well, like you did. And then some people play act. I didn't do too much of that. I was very much in the modeling, and I built sets of like, mm-hmm. you know, if you imagine an action film and freeze frame, I would try to do that. Like I had something in my head and I would put it together and then, you know, I could have taken a picture and I would just destroy it all and start over again. But yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that's a good point. I think that was actually a big part for me as well. I'd spend a lot of time. So I loved Lego Technic. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
Where you could build like, yeah. So I loved that Lego Technic basically allowed me to build what at the time was the closest possible thing I could think of building my own robot, right? Because I've always been quite fascinated with like robotics and mechanical things. And, you know, at the time I've always been pretty shit at math. So I never pursued a science career, but I had a keen interest in the whole idea of like robotics and mechanical things and stuff like that. So I'd spend a lot of time just ripping apart certain mega Lego Technic sets and then trying to do like, you know, a robotic hand or a robotic face and just playing with that. But to be honest with you, a lot of the times, now that you mention it, I would spend a lot of time building it, then spend a portion of time playing around with it, and then I'd be tired of it because I've already done what I wanted to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I had the same kind of thing. There was a post you wrote not so long ago about the 30 things you're still learning, I think.
Yeah.
And I picked out a few things that I thought was interesting. And one of the points you mentioned being that you were an angry kid. I was wondering how so or...
Well, basically, as with many, as many kids, as it happens to many kids, I had some like school bullying problems, and that then developed into a slight food disorder. And by food disorder, I mean I overate or I ate to compensate. So I gained a lot of weight from like 10 until like maybe 15, 16. And I think a lot of those things came from a profound belief that there was something deeply unfair about the world. So, you know, when you're bullied, you kind of go, why the hell me? And I think that kind of marked me a lot as I was growing up, because it meant that I wasn't as emotionally available to people. I was kind of in my head, I'm always mentally apologizing to my parents, who I have a great relationship with today, but I always go, oh my God, if I knew me at 15, I would have kicked the shit out of me based on how I treated my parents. But thankfully they didn't. They were very understanding and all of that. But it's just, you know, I grew up with this very deep dissatisfaction with a lot of things. And a lot of it I sort of expressed through drawings and then video games later on. So, you know, I was the prototypical example of a kid who loves violent video games, but hey, just happened not to be, you know, a total wacko, which was the concern at the time. But I don't know, it just sort of gave me a release from a bunch of the other things that I consider to be unfair about the world. Now, as I turned 30, I feel like, again, age is helping educate me a little bit, and life isn't always like that. But yeah, it's still something that I'm very mindful of, sort of how much do you give into anger and how rational it is. And a lot of the time it just isn't, but it is interesting to understand where it did come from.
Yeah, it is. And I know I haven't had to deal with much bullying, a tiny bit in junior high school, but not much. I guess I was lucky that way. But I know these days there's tons, particularly that it's just all over the place in the age of, you know, being anonymous on the internet and trolling mm-hmm. on the internet and everything else. So I don't know, there might be people who might be interested in the end. How did you knock it in the end? What was your, so I mean, you had coping mechanisms in terms of eating and video games and doing other things.
Yeah.
How did it end in the end?
It's hard, man. I think it's quite hard. I don't really know if there was like a key transition point, but I can point to a couple of episodes. So the first one was, and this is the cliche of answers, but getting a girlfriend helped a lot. But crucially, getting a girlfriend who was very patient and who was very understanding that, you know, there were a lot of things I needed to deal with. And we sort of just grew into each other with time. And by the way, this is the girlfriend I've been with for 12 years. So that worked out. But then before that, I think it was also, switching schools was important at the time. I switched to a different secondary school. And then in secondary school, and again, this might sound a bit like a cliche, but I basically went to a class where it was mostly girls, very few guys, but the girls were really, really nice. So we just all became really good friends. And I think, funnily enough, having more female figures in my life helped me calm down a little. Whereas with men, there's always that implicit sense of competitiveness and you know, you got to play football and be tough and all of that. And I've never really liked sports that much. So before I knew it, sort of having girl friends actually helped me sort of calm down and develop a bit of my empathetic side. And then the rest was just, you know, it wasn't always a linear thing, I don't think. So that was like two key moments and then a whole lot of years where I didn't even know where some of my implicit anger towards other stuff came from. But it's sort of, that was like the foundations, I think. It just helped me just be a bit more accessible to people.
Thank you. That's great. And in terms of direction, I think you studied communications or...
Yeah, so I studied communication sciences in uni, which is as broad as it sounds.
What was the appeal, if there was one?
It wasn't science. It wasn't maths. And I was good with languages. That was quite literally the criteria. So it was a bit of an exclusion of parts. And then at the time, I wanted to study journalism, and then I quickly realized that that wasn't really a really good career to pursue in Portugal because it's very hard and the money is shit, and you know, it just turned me off a little bit. But to be honest with you, it all started with I like languages. I'm pretty good in terms of English, so I never had to study that much for English, and I'd always have pretty good tests because I just really, really loved it, and I love languages. And then it was sort of like, okay, so where does languages lead me to? Humanities. Okay, what does humanities lead me to? Oh, communication. Yeah, that seems all right. You know, it could have gone a million other different ways, but it just ended up being that. But if I would be lying if I said that it was a totally conscious decision. I mean, looking back, it was pretty irresponsible how I chose my university degree. I just went to one of my neighbors and I was like, where are you applying to? He's like, I'm applying to this for international relations. And I was like, okay, well, I might apply where you are, but I don't like that course. But this communication sciences thing seems decent, so I'll go there instead. I'm not sure I would have made that decision the same way if I could go back, but you know.
If it reassures you, it was even, I mean, borderline might, I think, was even worse in terms of study, choosing which way I was going for studying. I was applying to literary prep schools in France, but most of my teachers were like telling me that I would not get in because they were basically looking at me like, Willem, I don't think, you're entirely capable, but... they were trying to delicately tell me that my attitude in school and the way they could see that I was not doing anything, but that I was bright, was like maybe not the best way to go for somebody who doesn't want to study that much. And I didn't have grades anyway. It's not, you know, so, but I still had to make a choice for university, and I was filling in my application. I was on vacation for summer break. And I just suddenly realized that I had to make a university choice and pick some kind of, you know, thing to study. And I just went through the list and I saw there was cinema and I was like, I like movies. Let's do that. And then for the following few months, I decided I wanted to be a film director. But that didn't last very long. Yeah.
How did you go to strategy then to like advertising?
I was going
to
ask you the same question. I'll go with mine fast. I went and studied that. It was very theoretical and I was very interested the first year. The second year I started losing interest and I started working in a bar. And then I worked at a bookstore and then I talked to people at the bookstore because after 3 months, oh, and then I was pretty much not going to school anymore the third year. And and I was working full time in the bookstore, and I talked to people who'd been there for 12 years and they were still doing the same thing that I just basically mastered in 3 months, more or less. And I was like, well, okay, this is good. It's nice to earn money, but I think I should do something else because I don't really want to be here in 12 years doing exactly the same thing. And I had an opportunity to go study graphic design, which is another area of interest of mine that I talked about with a friend. And he knew they were looking for somebody in his company. And so I started a degree that was part-time working with him, or which was an experiential events marketing agency, and part-time doing a graphic design degree for a couple of years. So I started out in design. And then I was looking for another job in design, and I completely differently had an opportunity to work in coaching and personal development programs with a company called Landmark that I knew because I'd done their courses and I knew people there. And they were like, well, actually, there's a job here. And I was looking for something. So then for several years, completely different direction, working in coaching and personal development. And that's when I moved from Paris to London. And then when I left there, I knew I wanted to go back towards creative communications of some kind, but no longer in design because I hadn't been touched design for a while. And while I like to think I have a creative mind, I was not that great a designer, like I'm, you know, I think. And one thing leading to another, well, what happened is I needed money fast. And so some people said, you should try recruitment. And I found a recruitment agency that hired for the digital marketing and advertising agencies. And I went there and I decided that would be the right stepping stone for me. And I met a lot of people in the industry. And when I came across what planning and strategy was, I was like, this is me. This is what I should be doing. So, yeah. So it was a little bit roundabout, but it took me a while. And then it was just a matter of starting to act and be and do the things that I could see other planners do. So that meant reading about brand and marketing. And that meant studying. And that meant sharing my thoughts on blogs and meeting people, and until I met somebody who gave me a shot. And that turned out to be George Lemaire, who was at Iris Digital at the time, and now has his own agency in Vienna.
Nice. Yeah. It's quite funny how a lot of people just stumble upon this stuff.
And this is me going fast. That's the quick version.
No, but it is interesting because I've never met many people who you ask, so how did you get into this job? And they go, oh, I've wanted to be in advertising since I was 10. And you're like, no one says that. People just go, oh, yeah, you know, I thought I wanted to be a programmer, but then couldn't be asked. So I ended up doing digital marketing. Or, oh, yeah, you know, I studied in arts and then it turns out I don't really want to do that. So one really good strategist who's fantastic to follow online, Rachel Mercer, I think she trained as a designer. So then she stumbled upon digital strategy and just went from there. So I really like people with different backgrounds that aren't like totally predictable.
Yeah, me too.
That being said, mine is completely predictable. So stumbled upon communication sciences. In order, I thought I wanted to be first a sports journalist. That didn't last long. Then I wanted to be, what was it? Oh, before that, I wanted to be a translator. So, you know, I have a penchant for low-paying jobs, apparently. During my course, I really liked a class called, it was something about basically cultural theory. And I thought, oh, that's quite nice because, you know, I get to talk about the meaning behind Batman and stuff like that. That is fucking brilliant. Can I make a job off of this? But then it turns out you couldn't unless you wanted to be an academic. So then I decided, oh, I think I want to get into PR because the same teacher who gave me that cultural theory and analysis class, she also gave the PR class, and that was quite good. I hated my marketing management classes at the time, but it turned out that it was because they were about marketing management, not creative marketing or creative brand work. So at the time, I just couldn't be fucked about the four P's and all of that stuff. So I kind of turned off to that. But then actually when I left uni and I was slightly lost for a bit about what I wanted to do, this was 2009, I stumbled upon this just job ad on an online portal in Lisbon, which said, we are looking for an online social media manager. And I was like, I don't know what that is, but I use social media. I think I can do that. And it turned out that I went to what was at the time the first social media agency in the country, or purely specialized social media agency in the country. And then I just realized that between that and then having pretty good bosses who I think they sort of on day one or day two, one of them turns to my desk and he goes, "Do you like to read?" And I was like, "Yeah, I like to read." So then he just drops a block of like six or seven books on my desk and say, "You might want to check some of those out at some point." So this was stuff like Free by Chris Anderson and some of the books by Seth Godin and some of the other stuff that, like, you know, if you look back now and if you're sort of a more or less seasoned strategy or marketing professional, you might sort of go, "Oh yeah, that's pretty fucking obvious. Yeah, you need to be interesting. Yeah, you know, freemium models are a thing." But at the time, it just opened up a whole new world in my head because it showed, so Seth Godin showed me that marketing could be highly creative and fun and interesting in a way that my classes couldn't. So suddenly that sort of framed everything I'd learned before about marketing, or everything that I remembered from the classes anyway, in a whole new different light. And so between starting to read more about this stuff and sort of trying to practice a lot of the stuff that I was reading, I decided that that felt like something I wanted to do. And then through some like specific guidance and mentors that I had at the time, my job was very like, let's call it multifaceted. So I didn't really know what a strategist did, but I kind of knew what an account manager did. I knew what creatives did. I had no idea what strategy was. But then actually talking to a guy who at the time sort of acted as a bit of a mentor, he kind of went, "Well, I feel like you'd be good at the strategy thing, so you might want to give it a go." And he just sort of helped refine a little bit what I understood that drove me in this industry. And then based on that, I decided to actually go and take a master's degree while I was working. And that turned out to be more of a formality than anything else, if I'm honest with you, because what would typically happen is I would work during the day, go study in the evenings, go to classes in the evenings. Because the curricula was so outdated at the time, basically I found myself, one, hearing about things that I knew for a fact weren't really true in my day-to-day reality, and two, a lot of the stuff that they were teaching was interesting, but they were so behind the times. So just to give you an idea, this is 2011, and one of my teachers who was in charge of the advertising program, she'd never heard about dynamic banners. She didn't know you could do interactive banners. And I was like, "Are you joking? Like, that's been around for, you know, 6-7 years already." And you see, you know, if you keep up with like the digital marketing blogs of the day, you could see a lot of that stuff every single day, just, you know, populating the feeds. But the reality is, because she was so in the academic world, and a lot of the teachers were basically just academics, I found myself sort of feeling a slight disconnect between academia and practice. So I finished my master's, but always with that ambition of like, this is going to be a piece of paper. There are some books that they recommend here that I want to check out, but by and large, I think I learn better through doing than just studying and writing an essay about it. And then that was kind of it. That's how I then found my general direction into what I wanted to do.
Awesome. That's great. And I was wondering, and just to just being conscious with time, there's a couple of things that I'm going to mix together. There was another point of your list of 30 things you're still learning is how to play, which I liked as well. And I find some of your stuff, particularly like how you published in the experiments and kind of like series you have on Instagram, like doodles and drawings. And these days you've started publishing these kind of like designy graphic, I don't know, motivation, not sometimes motivation. I thought they were kind of interesting and cool and playful, in my opinion, anyway. I was wondering if the way you use social media these days was the same as when you started out, or like how you came across to start playing around with different aspects of social media.
Well, I think it always came from that original principle of I learn better when I do, and then I sort of work backwards from that. But that being said, my approach to social media has changed quite a lot over the years. So I went from total obsession, immersiveness, to total rejection, to now I think finding a semblance of a balance between both of those worlds. So I really like tinkering with, you know, stuff like the Instagram typography is a fairly recent one. To be honest with you, I have no fucking clue what I'm doing there. I'm just seeing if I could do stuff in slightly different ways. The only guiding principle is I love words. I love writing. Can I make writing fun and visual? Beyond that, I'll be honest with you, Willem, half of the time I'm like, I don't even know what's like my guiding principle for this. Because some of it feels like quite self-helpy. Some of it is just like stupid puns. There's one that I did the other day, which was on Instagram. I'd go like, swipe right, and then people swipe right. And then I had a thing saying, lesson number one, don't do anything people tell you on the internet. Like, I don't know what the point of that is, apart from it just looks fun. You know, just stuff like that is exploration.
Did that just like come, oh, I have this idea, I'll just do it right now? Or do you have scheduled time to do, okay, now I'm going to do something for one of my social media or my Instagram? Or?
I used to have scheduled time. It doesn't really work for me emotionally because it removes the sense of play. It adds a feeling of duty and time and commitment. So what I do now is I'm far more spontaneous. So I think sort of in the back of my mind, I have a slight sort of antenna that there are certain things that sometimes I do want to share, but I don't try and force it anymore because I don't know, it just creates this, it starts feeling like a job as opposed to feeling like fun. And I don't know how you feel about it, but social media a lot of the time doesn't feel that fun anymore.
I agree. I was going to ask about how long you've rejected it because I'm just getting back on Twitter right now and like starting to appreciate a little bit. But for a while, I was barely ever like opening it or tweeting or at all.
It's really hard, man. And especially depending on who you follow. So on Instagram, so I'll start with Twitter. On Twitter, for example, I started by following basically everything I was interested in, including like news outlets and people and etc. It's too much. I can't follow The Guardian on Twitter. I love The Guardian, but I can't follow them on Twitter.
Yeah, I don't
like 720 tweets a day, I just get lost. So I have a few like ground rules, if you will, that allow me to not freak out over it. So one of them is I don't follow news organizations, but I'll follow the people that write for those organizations. So for example, if I want to dial up the amount of gaming stuff that I can look for on Twitter, I will not follow Kotaku, but I will follow the editor of Kotaku, because then journalists tend to be quite good at mixing the serious knowledge-based part of their jobs, but also just being really fucking good at just having fun at certain things. So, you know, one of my favorite people to follow on Twitter is the editor. I think she's the UK editor for BuzzFeed. She's called Katie, I cannot say her last name, but she's really good at just writing really funny tweets.
I'll find it to add it to the show notes.
Yeah. I can send you the link as well, because I'm pretty sure I can find it fairly quickly. But basically, the people over the organizations is sort of a big one for me in terms of following media stuff and news. And then the other thing is I don't I've been trying to consciously not feel the need to compulsively check it. I'll check it every now and then, like, you know, I'll do like a 5-minute check in the morning and then maybe a 5-minute check later on, but I try and avoid using it as a tool to fill up boredom. And I think that's kind of now one of the things I've been realizing around what I meant by learning how to play. I noticed that I'm very bad at dealing with boredom because for me, boredom is a missed opportunity for productivity. And I'm not sure I believe that anymore. You know, especially if you do creative stuff for a living, you need boredom and you need just some random vacuums where you're just literally staring out the wall or to the sky and just letting yourself be there for a little bit. And so I think that's kind of what I meant. And one of the reasons that I originally rejected social media a couple of years ago was precisely that I could not deal with it without that sense of like duty and structure. And if I'm using Twitter, I need to be like the most active Twitter user. And if I use Instagram, I need to be really fucking good at Instagram. And there's almost like that unnecessary weight on top of you over something that, you know, yes, it does have a professional role. I use Twitter for work stuff. I use LinkedIn to connect with other people who do what I do as well. And I won't lie to you. It's definitely something that I've used to try and build my profile a little bit. But it's my, you know, but they're my channels. If I'm not having fun with them and if I'm taking it far too seriously, then what's the point? You know, it's okay not to have a viral tweet, you know, but then equally, I'm very mindful of almost turning it into a trivial life casting tool. Like, I don't know. Ooh, I'm so angry with this thing. I cannot even, like, I don't know what that's doing to anyone apart from my own ego. So it's a fine line. I'm still trying to work that out.
It is an interesting one. And one thing that to add to that, which is, I read an article in The Guardian the other day, and I was talking about it with a friend last week because it's been on my mind, is comparison. The amount mm-hmm. of opportunities to go a little bit crazy in your head with comparison stuff is high. You know, in my case, it was looking at, oh my God, I just wanted to take a quick break on my newsletter and look at this. It's a year later. What the hell am I done with this? I've only published, I was like really crap with my podcast last year. Oh my God, look at Mark Pollard. He's doing all this amazing thing. I should be doing the same thing. Or look at this other person. Why am I not like them?
I think that's quite
help.
No, it doesn't. But, you know, it's kind of,
It's human at the same time. So to be able to, it's human and to be able to accept that. But there wasn't anywhere as many opportunities to compare oneself with another since, you know, the age of like social media right now. And
100%. And, you know, that's a really interesting thing to study, which is how much exposure is too much, you know? Even simple things like, you know, people who are obsessed with the news, I don't think the psychological toll of having breaking news in your head every 5 minutes is worth how much more quote unquote informed you feel. You know, I just don't see that much benefit from knowing that something was announced 2 minutes ago versus knowing it 2 hours from now. You know, there's exceptions, of course, but I don't know. There's just something that just puts unnecessary pressure on us. And I just wanted to say, because I sort of just did the Twitter part, but on Instagram, for example, I don't follow anyone I know. I follow artists. Because I realized that the thing that Instagram was filling in my life that I didn't have from plenty of other places was just an exposure to pure visual culture. And that's something that, you know, I did this joke a while ago that I follow Twitter people for the smarts and I follow Instagram people for the arts. You know, nice little iteration
that's
there.
But
the point being that
I might take a page from that, actually.
It's just, you know, because I've always liked visual stuff, not that I'm particularly good at it, but I just found that Instagram is really good to just get random visual inspiration, which does not mean following the best brunch shots. It means, for example, finding new ways of expressive ways of doing art. So, for example, my new thing these days is I love retrowave. If you don't know it, look it up through the hashtag retrowave. It's basically 80s futuristic, slightly dystopian graphic expression. And then also vaporwave is a similar strand to that. And then more recently, I'm very much into glitch art. And if I, just by following the hashtag glitch art on Instagram, I just get exposed to so many brilliant things that may not be to everyone's taste, but for me, they give me something that doesn't create that pressure to like perform or to, you know, document an amazing life. Like, you know, I don't really feel the need to talk about how amazing this photography of my sunset is, but there is a role around just pure visual culture that I find Instagram fills a little bit. But that's kind of the point. I use it as a conscious tool. I don't use it because it's just the thing I do, you know? And I think a lot of the times the burnout of using social media, and I speak from experience, is when you forget why you're using that thing. And you're using it out of compulsion or a need to fill up spare time. And I'm not so sure that's the best way of approaching it anymore, at least not for me.
I agree completely. All right, just being conscious of time, Lou, we're going to move and wrap up. And I have my end of interview new cool down questions. because it's the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. So just like almost to get into the groove of it, do you have a favorite ice cream flavor?
Pistachio.
Excellent. Is there a game you really enjoy and would recommend playing?
Shadow of War, but I know I'm 1 year late to the game.
Is that a video game? What is it?
I'm sorry. Video game, yeah. Oh, board game, Pandemic. Oh, it is amazing.
That's very good. That's very, very good. And Shadow of War is what type of game, just to get a sense?
It's from the Middle-earth series, so it's within the Lord of the Rings universe. It's RPG, open world, and it has the same fighting system as the Batman Arkham series.
Oh, yeah.
So, I remember that.
Cool.
Yeah.
On Pandemic, and just for the people who don't know, Pandemic is a collaborative board game where all the players are working together to eradicate a disease. And I just received a book that is all about designing principles for cooperative board games. And my plan is I want to find things in there that I can integrate in designing workshops for brands.
That's very good. I like that. Are you going to put notes on what that book is?
It's called Meeples Together, and I'll put the book in the show notes. I'll send you the link.
Very curious about that.
Yeah, I just got it. It was published by, there's a few people publishing books about games, and I got it on Kickstarter.
Nice.
Cool. What's the last or what's a last piece of art or media that had an impact on you?
That's a hard one, man. Is this like a speed response thing, or can I have just a few seconds to think about
it? I'm testing the questions, and people are taking a while, so my questions might be, they're not bad, but they might be too complicated. I don't know. The first thing that comes to mind, let's go for that.
The first thing that comes to mind.
Otherwise, I'm going to start asking you how you judge what the right answer is.
retrowave music, because music is art too.
Yes, absolutely. Excellent. And so that's the same style that you were talking about earlier. So that has like a 80s futuristic influence. Is that what it is?
Yeah. Do you know the Drive movie? You know the soundtrack
yes.
for that? That's retrowave.
Got it. Cool.
Yeah.
I think I would enjoy that. I'll have to check it out. All right. And what is something everyone should experience at least once?
Drawing.
Cool. And I'm testing this one, and I'm wondering if it's too close to the other one, but given you answered the last one quickly, I'm like, all right, great, I'll try it too. If you could give one thing to everyone, like you make a wish and everyone has it, what would that be?
Sunlight.
Oh, that's cool. I like it. Fantastic. All right, well, this was a lot of fun. Thank you very much, Rob. I really appreciated the conversation, just being mindful of time. We didn't have time. Oh, actually, you know what? I do want to take a couple of minutes to talk about your newsletter. And at the same time, we could just make sure that people have the link for it. So we mentioned it's called Solomon Theory, and we talked about it a tiny bit earlier. It seems like what you said about how you're experimenting with Instagram matched what you're doing with the newsletter, but I'd love to hear what your take on it is.
Well, the newsletter is kind of, it started off as, a way to just stand out, if I'm brutally honest, based on a question that a recruiter once posed to me, which was, how are you different from many of the other 40 planners I will meet today? And so I sort of started thinking hard about what is it that helped me? What is it that guides me to do this stuff? And then more crucially, what is it that guides me to strategy in general as a thing? And I just realized that throughout all my life or all my adult life, I've always been very much into philosophy as a way to deconstruct things that most people would take for granted. And I just found that that's kind of a lot of the times what I'm doing as a strategist. It's just deconstructing things, getting behind the skin of why things are the way they are. And so I just started tinkering with this idea that if there are certain ideas from philosophy books or philosophers that I enjoy reading, and if they give me sort of tangible tips to how I do my job or tangible perspectives, then maybe I should write about that and see if others feel the same way. And so I turned that into a newsletter. It was a perfect excuse to have a go at newsletters in a time when, again, I was already like 2 years late to the game, but I saw everyone was doing a newsletter, but everyone was doing like a, a link curation one. And I was like, I'm not really sure I have much to offer there, but maybe this philosophy and strategy thing might have something slightly different. And then after 6 months of doing that, so that was a year and a half ago, give or take, 6 months after doing that, I decided that I wanted to turn my interest in talking to people into another strand of the newsletter, which is the interviews part. So what happens if you subscribe to it is on 1 week, give or take, I will write something that I've been thinking about. And then on the other week, I'll have an interview with someone about what I call sort of the philosophy behind the work, which isn't to say that they need to be philosophy nerds, but they most definitely have a point of view, which is what I call their philosophy. So it's basically interviews with smart people, very similar to what you do with your guests. But yeah, that's kind of the gist of it. But I do like to tinker with it. You know, I like to put like GIFs in there and just have a bit of fun with it.
I've changed my format a few times. And just like you, when you started yours, when I started mine 3 years ago, I think 4 years ago, I was looking at how could mine be different from the links curation that was all over my inbox. And I started writing these articles. In the end, I changed because they were taking me too long to write. And but I did have some good echoes from it. So I do like your format a lot. And on the point of philosophy, I know that there's a lot more on that topic in the conversation you had with Mark Pollard. So if anybody's not listened to that conversation, I recommend it on the Sweathead podcast with Mark Pollard, where you talk about philosophy a lot more. Cool. All right. So they can look for Selman Theory on presumably Google. I mean, I'll add it to the show notes and then find you where else?
Just look up Rob is Typing. That's my handle on Twitter. And then based on that, you see the link to the newsletter and all the other bits and bobs. But probably Twitter is the best place to
see. All right. Cool. Thank you very much for your time, Rob.
Thank you, Willem.
All right. Well, thank you for listening. That was a fantastic conversation I had with Rob. I gave out a little bit more than I thought I would be giving out or talking myself in the conversation. But yeah, that's why it's a conversation. So, you know, my guests might have questions for me. Sometimes I'm a little bit conscious editing and re-listening to this, whether I'm repeating myself. I don't think I am, but hopefully, you know, you don't hear my same stories over and over again. I don't think so, but you know, you can always tell me if you do, which by the way, if you haven't reviewed the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast yet, I said at the beginning of the episode, please do give a rating and a review on iTunes. That's where most of the people listening. So you can go find on iTunes, whether it's on your laptop or hopefully, I think it works from your Apple Podcast app on your phone. You can go and give the rating 5 stars, please. That would be awesome. Or give it a shout out and share it with your friends on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter. And on Twitter, you can find me. My handle is ICVillain, letters I, letters C, W-I-L-L-E-M. And same thing on Instagram, if you want to find me and follow me there. And you can find everything else on the website at icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out. And my email, Willem, W-I-L-L-E-M, at icecreamforeveryone.net. Give me a shout if you need a strategist. I have free time at the moment, or at least certainly some time available for projects. So yeah, if you have any questions or anything else, don't hesitate giving me a shout. And if that's about it for now. So yeah, I'm going to be back with another guest very soon. I've been doing some more recordings. And in the meantime, have a fantastic afternoon, morning, day, night, whatever time of day or night it is for you. All right, thanks. Bye.